Welcome to another episode of Inside UMiami Medicine. My name is Amar Deshpande. I'm a gastroenterologist here at the University of Miami and Associate Dean for Medical Education, and I'm guest hosting today's episode that's focused on learners. So welcome. We're excited to have Harsh Mulani here. He's a remarkable individual who has done so many things both before medical school and while in school here at the Miller School of Medicine. Beyond his academic pursuits, Harsh started a very interesting organization we'll talk more about called Create Circles, which is a nonprofit that's focused on alleviating loneliness amongst nursing home residents. During our time together, we'll delve into some of the past things that Harsh has done and some of his future endeavors and how he balances all these things together. So welcome, Harsh.
Thank you for having me.
So before we talk about your nonprofit, I'd love to hear about kind of how things started. So you have a unique experience. You were born in another country and came here as a young child. So why don't you tell us about some of that early part of your life?
Sure. So I was born in Karachi, Pakistan, and my parents and I immigrated when I was 3 years old. We lived in New York for 2 years, and then we moved to a pretty rural area in Kentucky called Owensboro, Kentucky. And I think I loved it. A lot of people, whenever I say I'm from Kentucky, they're really confused because, you know, I don't particularly look like people. But I think growing up there, first of all, that's the only thing I've ever known. But second of all of my friendships, all of the people I met were actively formed. I feel like whenever you see people that look like you, you feel like you're supposed to be friends. But, you know, I became friends with people because I wanted to be good at soccer. And so those different experiences, I think, really were, they helped me become kind of who I am and how I present.
And it's great to hear, you know, so many times you hear maybe some of the other stories about the challenges moving from another country, particularly when you don't look or sound like the other folks. And you're right, you know, the stereotype of moving into kind of middle America into a small town in Kentucky versus maybe big city like New York City. But it sounds like you assimilated, you and your family assimilated very nicely, and it was a really good experience. And so tell me, during that time early in childhood, when did you first start thinking about a career in healthcare? We'll talk about some of the different aspects of healthcare that interest you. But when did you first start having this kind of calling, if you will, to medicine and the healthcare fields?
Yeah. So whenever we moved to Kentucky, most of the people in small town America that are of South Asian descent are typically business owners or physicians. And so we had a very small but, you know, robust community of other physicians that were also, you know, from Southeast Asia. And so because of that, I saw physicians my whole life. And a lot of times people are introduced to physicians as like the people that take care of them. But for me, it was just like my best friend's dad. And so I feel like I was introduced to physicians as just a career choice rather so than a calling. And then as I grew older, as people started, whenever you start talking about colleges and what you're going to do, it was natural for me to think, oh, maybe medicine, something I could look into. But only through volunteer experiences, shadowing, did I actually start to turn this like seed into something that like I actually want to call my calling.
That's great. So, of course, there's two aspects, right? Because seeing people that are physicians as friends or as your friend's parents gives you kind of one aspect to the social aspect of how they live their life, but not necessarily how they practice medicine or some of the some of those aspects. So what other things? So obviously family was a big part of just being around people in the medical field. What else kind of in terms, you mentioned a little bit about experiences, whether it was shadowing or volunteering or doing some work in healthcare. Maybe talk a little bit about that and specifically how that was in high school. I know you had kind of a unique high school experience related to healthcare.
Yeah. So whenever I feel like there are a couple of experiences that really stand out. I was born in Karachi, Pakistan. We were visiting there one summer and I actually got typhoid. And it was miserable. I was completely out of commission. I was vomiting. I couldn't keep anything down. And I distinctly remember the like only person I wanted my parents or anyone to talk to was my pediatrician. And I feel like that was a really powerful moment just because I knew that like in a time where I was completely, I couldn't do anything, like the first thought I had was like, I need to see a doctor. And so I think that was a huge component. And then one of the places, while Kentucky, growing up in Kentucky, wasn't necessarily the best place for belonging. Whenever I was a sophomore, I applied to this residential high school at Western Kentucky University called the Gatton Academy. It's a public school, completely free for all students that get accepted. And you basically go and you live on Western Kentucky University's campus for 2 years and you take college classes. So it's basically you take a dorm and everyone in that dorm is high schoolers, but you live like college students. And so while I was there, I was exposed to a couple of things that I think made a huge difference. One, that's whenever I started doing research. So I joined a basic science lab where we were doing research on antibiotics and gold nanoparticles. I had other people that aspired to be physicians. In Owensboro, there weren't that many people that wanted to do something like medicine. Or if they did, it was more closer to nursing. But I've always saw myself as a physician. And so seeing other people that also had that passion and kind of taking the coursework. So I took a neuroscience class as a senior in high school. And so things like that, I think, really helped me change what my understanding of medicine was, and as well as like other people that aspire for a similar position.
Got it. I was thinking of myself at 16 on a college campus. You're far more mature than me to be able to pull that off successfully. But it was great because you got an opportunity to really live that college lifestyle, at least the academic part of the college lifestyle, for those couple of years. And so that was STEM in general, or was that really focused on just healthcare, that high school?
It was a math and science academy.
Okay.
And so they gave us the freedom to take further, coursework in those fields. If you wanted to do genomics, you could do that. If you wanted to take linear algebra, you could do that. And those are typically not opportunities available to high schoolers.
So that kind of further helps solidify some of your experiences in research that you mentioned and caring for patients. That's great. So then the next transition for you was to go to college. And so you stayed in the in that kind of part of the country-ish, right? And you went to Wash U and focused on neuroscience. So maybe tell us a little bit about why the initial interest in neuroscience. Is that really something that you had in the past, or was that just an opportunity to study an exciting field?
I think that neuroscience for me, there are a couple of things that happened. Whenever I first got into the Gatton Academy, my grandmother, she had a meningioma, and I saw how my dad reacted to that, while also at the same time, I was taking a neuroscience class. And so there are these like different things happening in my life where, you know, it was the clinical side as well as the science side, and I found that part really interesting. Additionally, the neuroscience major at Wash U had this 9-hour neurophysiology lab where you would be there for 9 hours and you would do all sorts of experiments. And it, like whenever you read the literature, these experiments were like the types that, you know, groundbreaking research looked like in the 1950s. And so I think that part, just to be able to do something very hands-on, but connect that to the science component, added kind of a layer to what I thought medicine was.
Got it. And so if college isn't busy enough and you were already kind of thinking about medical school based on your prior experiences growing up and in high school, so this was already kind of a pre-med track, I presume, while you were there. So busy enough doing all that stuff and trying to put forth the meaningful kind of set of credentials for medical school, you did it something extra and decided to start an organization. Probably it's initially smaller in scope, and we can talk more about how it's grown over time. But tell me a little bit about Create Circles. Like, what was the inspiration behind creating this, and some initial kind of experiences that led you to think that this was an important organization to start?
So whenever people ask me about Create Circles, I think it's almost a misnomer to think of it like me just starting this organization. A lot of times people don't see kind of the 2 years of work I did in elder care prior to starting. And so the initial start was actually I missed all of the deadlines for being an EMT on campus. I missed all the deadlines for all the cool health pre-med track clubs. And I was like, oh man, I need to do something cool. And so I started reaching out to different organizations in the area, and there was a hospice that was looking for volunteers. And so I started out in hospice where I was seeing these older adults who were at the end of their life, but as any good hospice should, they gave me kind of patients that were more mentally present early on. And one of them, we had a great relationship where we would come in and we would talk. He would tell me all sorts of stories. And I saw that over time, he became really interested in just like understanding what was going on in the world, and he wanted to give back in some way. But the issue was I was effectively the only person that came in and saw him. And so that's whenever I first started to think, and just wonder, why is this the case? People that have done so much in their lives, given to their community for so long, why at the end of their lives are they lonely? And that, from that point on, I grew my responsibilities in that hospice first. So I went from one patient to 8 patients a week. And I would just drive to different parts of St. Louis, and I would be going to all these nursing homes. And I would see that. But in the process, people would always kind of wonder who I was. And so I would talk to them, and they would start introducing me to people, which I think is special because, you know, elder care isn't particularly glamorous. And so whenever there's a young person interested in it, people want to help them. And so I started talking to the Alzheimer's Association in St. Louis. I started talking to the Oasis Institute, which does kind of work before long-term care and keeping people engaged. And I wanted to better understand the policies. And so all of these different things kind of came together. And ultimately, I came to this realization with Create Circles is that with loneliness, particularly in long-term care, we're trying to fix it with companionship, right? If someone's lonely, let's give them someone else to talk to and they'll be okay. The issue is loneliness is more so an effect rather than a cause, right? Something happened in order to make them feel lonely. So if you are trying to give them someone to talk to, it's just a Band-Aid. They'll feel good for that conversation, but what about the rest of the time? And so those were kind of the initial realizations I had. And I thought it was an interesting and big enough problem that I wanted to put some energy towards solving it.
It's fascinating because you really highlighted some of the aspects of how we currently deal with elder care in this country and maybe some of the challenges and pitfalls. And I like how you kind of flipped the cause and effect on its head. And we're trying to fix the problem, but just going after them after it's already too late. So tell me a little bit about the model of Create Circles. How is this different than just saying, I'm going to create an organization where interested high school and college and medical students or retirees or whomever are going to hang out for an afternoon with person X? Like, how is the model different to help address this root cause?
Sure. So whenever we started Create Circles, the premise that we built was that if loneliness is the effect, what is the cause? The cause is a lack of purpose. And we tried to, lack of purpose can be almost it's abstract. And so we wanted to paint that in more distinct categories. And we kind of nailed it down to 3 based on clinical research as well as different people we talked to. One is, have you lost connection with your identity? So if someone owned a pet their whole life, they took care of pet for so much of their life, but now they're in a nursing home, are they still a dog owner or are they not? And so there's that disconnect. The second part is, do you have anything that you're anticipating or looking forward to? So in a nursing home, if your day-to-day life is the exact same, you wake up, someone takes care of you, someone feeds you, and every day looks the same, you kind of lose that looking forward to component. And then the third component is, can you give back? A lot of times we don't feel best about ourselves whenever we are receiving, but more so whenever we are giving. And the reality is we enjoy giving because that shows that we have something to give, right? If you have nothing to give, you can't give. And so based on those 3 premises, we built a goal-oriented curriculum that focused on how do you take 2 people and build a project organically over the span of 8 to 12 weeks. So for example, we have a volunteer who's trained in our curriculum, and then through their conversations, they will, over the span of weeks, start to learn more about the other person in a way that at first is very organic and then becomes directed. So we had a woman named Kathy, who was the resident, and a volunteer named Anna. And Anna heard that, you know, Kathy really enjoyed cooking and things like that. So once she asked her for a recipe, and Kathy talked about the recipe and the best time that they made it and the worst of the time that it horribly failed. And over time, they started doing this every single week. It became a ritual. And once you have that ritual, if you do it 8 times and you've started recording what those stories were and what those recipes were, you can present a goal in a way that doesn't feel unachievable. A lot of times in nursing homes, you know, if someone has never made a cookbook and you tell them, let's make a cookbook, they'll be like, oh no, I can't do that. How am I supposed to do that? But if you already have 8 recipes, like, oh, you know, if we add 8 more, maybe we can make a cookbook and we can share with other residents in the community. And because of that, I think that's what really helped Create Circles become more of it gave us a way to kind of address this problem more head on.
So that's very interesting because you took a lot of the substrate that already exists, a group of patients who need or folks in elder care who need support and help a group of volunteers are interested in helping, but rather just kind of a free-for-all where go talk to them about whatever you want, created a kind of very designed curriculum. So that's great. I love how you articulated the three specific points. So tell me a little bit about mentorship at this point, right? Because you are not a geriatrician, you are not an expert in maybe the medical aspects of this or the psychological aspects of this. So how did you kind of figure out what those three things were and what kind of mentorship did you get along the way to help guide creation of this, at least from the content perspective?
Sure.
Whenever I started talking to people about my interest in this, it started out with my hospice activities, or the volunteer coordinator. And she noticed that I was really passionate about it. So she introduced me to one of the vice presidents of the hospice, who was then, enjoyed how I talked about it and just the passion that I had. So she was like, oh, you know who's great? There's this geriatrician at WashU that, you know, maybe I can introduce you to. And so a lot of the mentorship I got was purely coming to people, talking about what I was thinking, what was going on, any early results we had. And those people were super excited to just connect me to others. And I think it loops back to the thing that I was saying, where if you're doing work in a field that does not necessarily have much of the glamour around it, there is abundance of opportunities. So many people, I think, were just excited to see a young person care about nursing homes. And because of that, I think it allowed me to get in touch with so many geriatricians and neurologists while at WashU to just understand how does cognition or something like how we interact with our day-to-day lives, like a psychologist may approach it from, kind of come together to create the problems that we're seeing.
So yeah, I think that you kind of highlight the fact that sometimes people say, what's your mentorship program? And have you created A, B, and C? But a lot of this was organic, right? As you developed an interest, you know, then find targeted mentors for specific aspects of what you did. So tell me a little bit, if you have any, about outcomes. So this sounds great, but are there any tangible outcomes that you could have acquired over time to show that this, in fact, was a better way for to provide support for elders compared to the historical kind of the historical model?
Sure. So and if you don't mind, one more thing I would like to add to the mentorship thing is, I think what helped me is I was in the pursuit of questions. So whenever I was thinking about nursing homes, I was thinking about like what policy things are causing these. And so whenever I had a specific question, people would connect me to someone who could help answer that question. So I think the pursuit of questions rather than answers, I think also kind of helped build that mentorship. In terms of our program,
That, by the way, is a great way to approach all of science, right?
Right.
Really starting with the questions. That's great. So I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. So in terms of our program, so we had one study done with three nursing homes where we basically saw that after an 8-week period, we did pre and post surveys using the UCLA loneliness scale and then a purpose and life validated survey. And both of those showed that we, within 8 weeks, improved loneliness by 30% as well as sense of purpose by 30%. And so this is on PubMed if you want to search for it. And so we had pretty great results pretty early on.
Out of curiosity, any work you did in assessing the volunteers and what they got out of that, perhaps with what traditional volunteers might get, did they find a greater sense of purpose and achievement as opposed to just saying, I went to see someone for eight visits, but now I got to I got a cookbook out of it, right? I got some head of a product. Have you looked at that aspect from the volunteers?
Yeah, so a lot of the volunteer confidence levels, the things that we were really interested in is how comfortable do you feel talking to patients? Improved by 30%. How comfortable do you feel talking to a stranger? Improved by 50%. And so I think the things that we noticed was whenever you put people in a situation that feels very open, you could talk about anything. But you know, eventually, once you kind of have a seed to start the conversation, where to take it, a lot of the volunteers felt more confident in these situations. And I think they also enjoyed it because the reality is a lot of clinical volunteering, especially at an undergrad level, you can't do much. You don't know much. You don't have the capacity to help in the ways that you want to help. But if it comes down to having a conversation with someone, you feel like this is meaningful to you while also beneficial to the patient.
Great. So I heard one point that you made specifically about how policy interested you, right? and not just how you can fix one problem for one person, but what are the policies in place that can allow you to be more successful? So tell us a little bit about how you're interested in policy, whether that contributed to, you know, I know you wanted to go to medical school, but how that might have affected your decisions. And let's maybe pivot a little bit towards how your time has been in Miami. You ended up coming to medical school here, but why did that at all affect your decision about getting in, applying for the MD-MPH program versus perhaps a straight MD?
Absolutely. I think policy for me was a means to understand the system that we have built. So in nursing homes, it helped me understand, why does it feel like there's understaffing in one nursing home and not in another? And by understanding the ways that the Medicaid system is set up, all of these things, extremely complicated, and a Google search, I wish could explain it to me. I wish ChatGPT could explain it to me.
But it will soon.
It will soon, but it's not there yet. And so for me, the reason that I ended up wanting to get an MD-MPH in particular is because I think that an MD on the ground level helps you really understand what's happening and how to deliver care. Additionally, a lot of my best ideas came from whenever I was talking to patients, right? It kind of set off something where then I would have a question to further explore that's a much deeper question. The policy part or any admin component is, how do you structure care? So I think the MD-MPH was important because it teaches you both how do you deliver care and structure it. So together you're able to paint a system that is able to look good on a whiteboard as well as, you know, in reality.
Sure. And so we'll talk a little bit about how your medical school experience has shifted some of the ways in which you dealt with the organization. But before that, when you were still in college, we had a little thing of a pandemic that hit. And now all of a sudden, it sounds like your organization was very built upon people going and seeing elders. Live visits were harder to do. Vulnerable populations in particular, and of course, as we all remember from the very earliest parts of the pandemic, the first thing that we probably heard in the U.S. was nursing homes in the Northwest, right? So tell me how the pandemic had forced you to shift and pivot and what you kind of did to address the challenges that the pandemic laid for you in this particular field.
So we started the organization in May 2019. And so pandemic was approximately 9 months into it. And so we were actually starting to grow in terms of on the ground. Pandemic hit, everyone quit responding to us for about a week. And in that week, we were pretty confused on what to do. And then all of a sudden, we got all of these messages, not only from the organizations that we were working with, those nursing homes, but also additional ones that were like, we have residents here, they can't see their family. Can your program help? And I'm always the type of person that says yes, and then I get off the phone and I try to figure out how we can do it. And so what we ultimately did as a team is we went from in-person visits to virtual meetings. The CMS did a great job in allocating resources to help nursing homes make this switch very quickly. So they allocated $3,000 or $1,500 for every nursing home to be able to purchase iPads and tablets. And so many of these nursing homes weren't aware of this. And so the first thing we started doing is we helped them get the tablets, and whether they were paying out of pocket for it or with that grant funding. And then once they had those tablets, every college student at that point was used to Zoom. And so we were able to switch pretty quickly, and we started doing virtual visits, which we were surprised by how much we were able to still maintain a lot of the organization. A lot of our communication is nonverbal, but through Zoom, we were able to still kind of have these meaningful conversations at a point when, you know, many of these residents couldn't even see their family.
Yeah, you know, I started the question thinking of all the challenges of the pandemic, but in many ways, your organization was one of the best suited to really grow.
Yeah, we grew.
Because it really kind of highlighted the value of the interactions that you guys put together. So you mentioned CMS. So I would be remiss without mentioning that it's not common that a medical student gets a grant for $500,000. You're about $5,000 short, so you should have just asked for a little bit more. Very impressive, obviously, to get such a big grant. So tell me a little bit about, and particularly as a medical student, so please tell me about what made you kind of think about this grant and what this grant specifically addresses in your organization.
So the reason for the grant was we had a program that was doing well, but it was built entirely on people's goodwill. And when I say people's goodwill, I mean volunteers that are visiting the residents. They're all volunteers, obviously. Everyone in the organization, like me, is also a volunteer. And so I wanted to build something that could run even if something were to happen to me. And the only way you can truly do that is if you have employees. And so what I was looking for is, how do we scale up our organization in a way that's sustainable? And the only way you can truly do that in a place like nursing homes, where it's much harder to kind of get people to pay for services, is through grant funding. And so CMS, also during COVID, what I would do is, they would have these monthly updates where they would basically, you know, say different programs they're launching and things like that. And one of them, I saw that they had a grant for purely for improving quality of life for long-term care residents. I was like, oh,
could it be a better one? Yeah,
we do that. And so once we saw that, we started putting together an application. We submit it. They gave us feedback. We submit it. They gave us feedback. And this would happen for a year and a half.
Welcome to the rest of your life.
Yeah. And it continued for a year and a half. But luckily for us, you know, we were passionate about it. I had enough people that really wanted this to continue to happen. So I think purely by being present there for a year and a half and just following up is the reason we ultimately got the grant, and probably, hopefully, a decent application as well.
The real value of persistence. That's great. So just in the last few minutes, I'd love to pivot just to really focus on your Miami experience. So tell me a little bit, now that you've been in Miami for, I guess, almost 3 years now, how has your medical school experience informed some of the work that you do with this organization? And how, conversely, has the organization maybe informed some of your decisions about what to do moving forward in medicine as a specialty, for example?
Sure. Whenever I came into med school, I feel like I understood the psychosocial component of care fairly well, but it's very hard to understand the series of things that happen prior to someone ending in a nursing home. And so all of my clinical experiences have been so good because, one, I've seen what it looks like whenever someone has a heart attack or a stroke or a fall, even, to like have them lead up into a nursing home. And so I think a lot of those clinical experiences were just a huge part of my knowledge base that we're missing. And by having that, I, one, saw that the work that we do in older adults and long-term care is important, but you see this loneliness all across medicine, right? Someone that's getting chronic dialysis is also extremely lonely and starts to become disconnect from their community. Many prepartum women who have a rupture of membranes prematurely, they are also hospitalized for a series of time where, you know, they're lonely, disconnected from the normal pregnancy process. And so I think I've started to see that the work that we do is not just can and should only be focused on older adults, but it can actually expand to many other areas of medicine. So I think that was very fascinating. In terms of the work that I've done, I think just the process of talking to older adults and just really enjoying it. And I think in nursing homes, I became used to speaking with people that had chronic conditions that weren't going to be resolved. So their Parkinson's was an active thing that they were grappling with. Their dementia, all of these different things affected their day-to-day life. And I think because of that, I just really enjoy talking to those people. I enjoy talking to the caregivers. I enjoy understanding their challenges and trying to make it better in whatever way I can. So because of that, I want to pursue neurology.
So what a great thread, right? From neuroscience in college to doing something that really focused on the mental health aspects, right, of loneliness and feeling valued, and then kind of close that loop, if you will, in the brain health space, space of neurology. So just in closing, and thank you so much for your time. This has been really such a great conversation. I'd love to hear your thoughts for, let's say, folks that are thinking about a journey into medicine. How did you balance all of this, right? Trying to figure out how to apply to medical school and start an organization, and then while you're in medical school and trying to figure out how to, you know, take tests and study for exams and see patients while also managing your organization. So what advice would you give to future or current medical students or those interested in starting a journey into medicine about how to kind of take the passion and take all the other work that's associated with this and kind of balance everything?
I think that prior to medical school, a lot of the things we're doing is trying to keep doors open. We do a bunch of things and then we're just constantly trying to keep doors open. And I think that in medical school, it's also important to, you you know, explored the different areas of medicine out there just because there are so many options. But as future physicians, we get really good at pursuing a lot of things and doing them well enough that it's not bad. And I think the way that you free up time is you get really good at closing those doors and you focus on a door to walk through whenever you kind of have an inkling. And the reality is anytime you walk through a door, it rarely means that like this is the thing you have to do. But the pure process of putting a lot of time, energy in something helps develop that passion in a way that you couldn't do if you were balancing 15 other things. So I think the biggest piece of advice I have is get good at saying yes and then learn how to say no. Because I think once you say no often, you get really good at the thing that you enjoy doing. And over time, you can kind of turn it in whatever direction that you want. And so I think the best way to create time is to ultimately start saying no to things that just may be meaningful, maybe meaningful to your application. But the process of saying no there opens up the ability to do something great in the few things that you really love.
I think you've been a great example of that, right? Of how you pulled that off. So this has been a great conversation. I'm actually proud of myself that I didn't mention the India-Pakistan cricket rivalry this whole time. Well, not really a rivalry because we're so much better, but I really want to thank you for your time. This was fascinating to hear about all you've done before medical school and while you're in medical school to create a fantastic organization while still balancing becoming a future physician. So again, thank you and really appreciate it. So thanks for joining us for another episode of Inside UMIME Medicine. Thank you very much.